We want to identify the porch of the gate, post, pillars, and palms, and in Ezekiel chapter 40 and 41 with regard to the gate buildings. So we'll go through this pretty quick. We want to recognize how these features will be utilized in the house of prayer during the worship and praise services for the nations. We want to learn the spiritual exhortations that these features have so that we might be edified as a people. The temple porches. There's a lot of powerful spiritual lessons that are involved from a consideration of the history of the temple porches. For instance, if you go back to Ezekiel chapter 8, that describes a monumental apostasy of Israel which occurred between the porch of the temple and the altar in Jerusalem. If you look at that in Ezekiel chapter 8, take you a half second, verse 16, and you'll notice it says, God is speaking to Ezekiel, and verse 15, then said he unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abomination than these. And he's already turned him a couple of times, and he's looking in this temple, and he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the door of the temple of Yahweh, between the porch and the altar, notice the highlighted emphasis between the porch and the altar, were about 5 and 20 men, with their backs toward the temple of Yahweh, and their faces toward the east, and they worship the sun toward the east. Now, we've already talked about why the tabernacle and Solomon's temple and the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy is all going to be based or built in a position to where the gates face a person entering in the eastern gate, most important gate, who will have their back to the sun. And what does it say in that chapter? And we notice that these men had their backs to the temple and worshiping the sun. It's a vision in Ezekiel 8 of idolatry among the children of Israel, among the elders of Israel. But all this will be a thing of the past in the bright millennial age, as we read in Zechariah 13:2, and we'll get to that in another class, probably that fourth class that we almost started. When the porches of Yahweh will be frequented by men and women of a circumcised heart, the purity of worship in Ezekiel's temple is thrown into strong relief by a deliberate reference to the apostasy of the past, and as we shall see when we come to look at Ezekiel 44. Difficult to read, but we just read the verse in chapter 8 about they had their faces, these 25 men had their faces toward the east, worshiping the sun toward the east. Now, in the diagram before you, you see a floor plan of Solomon's temple, and you see these men represent the 25. They are between the porch and the altar. The porch is just an extension of the door of the temple, almost as though it were a preparation before the priest went inside the temple. But these men are between the altar and the porch, and their backs are towards the temple. Now they're facing the sun's rising. And there is even in that chapter, as you'll notice, in chapter 8, let me just point this out to you, a worship of the sun and the worship of Tammuz up in verse 14 by the women, and these 70 men in verse 11. It's just the whole chapter is dealing with the idolatrous worship of Israel. And even in verse 12, he said unto me, son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery? And that takes us to the imagination. That's why we need to put something solid in the imagination of God's Word, an enlightened, solid feature. Now, if you have an idea about the temple and you just refuse Brother Sully's work and you think that he's just off in left field somewhere, but get you a vision of the temple, okay? This may be wrong, according to my inspection. I don't believe it is, but if you need something to grasp hold of and to let your life revolve around in the kingdom age, something solid that you can hold on to mentally and use your imagery and imagination and let it be radiated by the accuracy of Scripture. So These men are worshiping the sun in verse 16 toward the east. That sun is an interesting phrase. We're doing a study in Ecclesiastes in our midweek Bible study in North Houston, and the phrase occurs 29 times in Ecclesiastes, indicating a limiting factor in a man's life. This is why Koheleth, which is the same name for Solomon, his perspective changes when he uses the term he sees the sun in Ecclesiastes 7 in verse 11 and verse 11 and 7. The sun is a source of light like the Word of God. Light allows us to see a contrast between the dark and the light, the shades and the highlights in a painting, between good and evil. If we're blind, like I was telling you young people last night, of healing a blind man in a dark cave, it doesn't do much good. You've got to get the cave enlightened so that he doesn't fall off some precipice down into an abyss. So you can heal a blind man, but you got to heal the environment of the blind man that he might walk and have a light before him. Otherwise, pitch darkness, if you've ever been in a dark place, you understand what I'm talking about. Also, having a darkened environment with a man with healed eyes, or having a blind man in an environment that is full of light, having an individual come into our ecclesia from the outside who has not been enlightened, they would be blind, and you would try to say, well, why don't you understand this? Well, they don't understand because they haven't been instructed. In the eyes of man's eye, the eyes of a wise man are in his head. And so you have to instruct a man's mind or a woman's mind to heal those eyes that they might be able to receive the impressions and the signals of light of the rainbow and the beautiful rainbow of the gospel of the kingdom of God. So through this light, a man gains a view of God's word in filling the earth with his glory. God's glory is that moral excellence that he will institute in the earth by instructing all men and women and children and families and leaders and elders. So he's going to instruct them in the ways of righteousness. So when a man views life under the sun, he is unable to view the source of light and therefore is in a state of ignorance concerning God's purpose. So under the sun, natural light, it's interesting, that term. Verse 9, we read, he measureth the porch of the gate. This is back in Ezekiel chapter 40. And he measureth the porch of the gate, 8 cubits, its post 2 cubits, and the porch of the gates from within. So this porch that we just showed on Solomon's temple, now in Ezekiel's temple, is stated to be inward. That is to say, it stands clear of the gate building and is inside the court. From the court in which this measurements are given, the two porches appear to adjoin each other as shown in plate 5. The two form sort of an inner and outer porch, 1 6-cubits wide within the main structure of the gate building, on the one side of the door and the other with posts projecting 10 cubits into the outer court. We'll see that porch as figure H. And this is an illustration of it. He measureth the porch. Now that porch area is H that we just spoke of. And this is that little area considered to be the porch of the building. So when you read that in chapter 40, verses 7 and 9, and verse 7 through 9 and verse 15. So if we read chapter 40, verse 7 through 9, it says, in every little chamber with one reed long and one reed broad, and between the little chambers were 5 cubits. Threshold of the gate by the porch of the gate within was one reed. He measured also the north, or the porch of the gate within, one reed. Then measured he the porch of the gate 8 cubits. And so we're giving you some orientation, architectural orientation, as to where you are as you come through the gate building. We've come through from the 7 steps, if it were here, in relation to this area. We've reached the doors. The doors swing open, and we'll look at those in a moment. But then you walk out into the porch, and you open up into that glorious courtyard that you will be able to view one direction as you turn right coming out. And you turn right, and you look, you'll see one of the towers. You turn completely 180 degrees, you'll see a mirror image of the kitchen towers. And that's what those towers are all about, is kitchens to cook the meals for both mortals and immortals. And it will be the finest food that has passed the palate of any individual. It will be carefully inspected. My wife, Wendy, she says, your teeth are too well matched. You catch every grain in every bite of anything I fix. And I can't help it. It just, we're going to experience the greatest, highest form of culinary art the world has ever seen when these Levite priests begin to cook what is brought up from the reserve of the land that God has given to the mortals. It will be absolutely amazing. So the cella between the inner court gates on the north side is first mentioned in the description of the north gate of the inner court from chapter 40, verse 38. So let's look at that verse, chapter 40, verse 38. We read, and the chambers and the entries thereof were by the posts of the gates, where they washed the burnt offering. And in the porch of the gate were two tables on this side, two tables on that side, to slay thereon the burnt offering. And really that word is to flay, and the sin offering and the trespass offering. So they washed these, and you'll see, I'm going to back up and show you those tables again in the porch. You see these tables? These are tables. That little L, you'll see that on the plate of Brother Sully's. This is from his book. And you'll also see that on the legend that describes the alphabet, you'll see that these little L's refer to the tables. That's where they will actually have the meat hooks will be hanging there. There'll be sacrifices laid out or flayed out that have already been killed on the north. And that's where this is. So they will be, the priest will actually be preparing this meat in open view. Now that might seem a little unusual, but what Christ, I believe, is trying to do is to expose us to the source of sin. He really had to do this through, as you know, if you've done a study on the Levitical offerings, when the Levite priest would accept the offering from an individual who would come up, they would have to place their hands on the head of the bullock or the goat or the lamb, and they would actually put their weight on it so that when the priest took a knife and put it through the up to the throat of the animal and cut downward quick, there was a surgical process involved in all of this because they didn't want the animal to suffer. But once the animal succumbed to the free flow of oxygen and blood, then they began to examine the animal on the tables. And we see those lessons brought out in Hebrews constantly, that double-edged knife of the priest was examining the innards and the pancreas and all of the innards of the sacrifice in order to make sure that there was nothing that animal had gotten into while grazing that would cause growths or cause tumors or blemishes inside of that animal, and that animal was cared for, and that the sacrifice of that animal was going to be based upon the inner workings of that animal's digestive tract. You see, it's a physical object lesson for the offerer, because that animal represented the offerer, and it's going to be no different in the kingdom age, that the animals in which are brought up for on behalf of families and tribes in that day will actually be offered up on the altar at the center of the temple, and a portion of it, rather. So a portion of that, but that animal will have to be as clean as every animal was under the Levitical law, even cleaner, and there won't be any corners cut and compromises. And people saying, well, I can slip you a 10 spot if you'll let that animal slide. I don't want to have to go back and purchase a new animal or whatever. And there will be animals for purchase during the kingdom age. But the whole principle will be that the inside is now seen of people. Today, how can you judge each other's motives? How can we judge each other? We can't judge each other's motives. We can only see by their actions, like someone once said, the older I get, the more I watch what people do over what people say. And, you know, we have good intentions at the time, and we say we're going to do such and such, and I'm the world's worst about this. I'll do such and such. Send me an email if you want this slide, you want this file, you want this idea. But we forget. Our flesh is so weak, we're such leaky vessels, and we fail so miserably. But in that day, there's going to be attention drawn to the inner man, that our motives are going to be open and visible unto him with whom we have to do. So the whole process of the temple, I believe, is to get the masses to come through and see that Christ is really dealing with the inner spirit of an individual through object lessons such as the sacrifices and what we will see in the temple itself. So these cella, and I think we just looked at that. So the chambers or the cella are related to the gates in the same way as are those of the outer court. They occupy the area between the gates, and with the inner court gates, they form an integral part of the inner court, but their entrances face the outer court. The outer face, in other words, he's describing the mirror. In other words, if I back up a little bit, you'll notice that these gates, these cella, and these gate buildings here are mirrored by these here. And so they face each other. So what's going on over here is actually the same that's going on over here. So on the north, these gates, these flaying tables, as we looked in that previous slide, are mirrored on the other side of the courtyard, which is this 200-foot wide area called A. Not here, but here, the white area. So these gates are facing each other. It's like a mirror image of those gate buildings with flaying tables, where the process of butchering and proportions will be taken down to the western side, down to the eastern side. These temple or towers will be the kitchen towers where this food will be processed, or the animal portion will be processed, just like the grain portions will be processed. So he brought me forth into the outer court, the way toward the north, and he brought me into the chamber that is over against the separate place. Now that's going to be between the circular building and the square building, and which is before the building toward the north, before the length of 100 cubits, or 200 feet, is the north door. So that's two-thirds size of a football field. Now we take a look at chapter 46, verses 6 through 16. The outer east gate sets the pattern for all. We've already examined that. Okay, these are 60 feet pillars, 20 feet wide. And I wanted to show you these doors of what's called a Great Hall of Buddha. These are massive doors in the Orient, and in China, I believe. And these massive doors, as you can see, they just tower over this individual, and they're on hinges. And so, I don't know. Has anyone ever been to China and seen anything like this? I've never have. But here in America, we don't make doors quite like that in office buildings or cathedrals. There may be some. I'm just unaware of them. But in the Kingdom Age, every one of the gates will have doors like that. As you noticed back in, I think we'll see them here in just a minute. Again, these are the chambers. These little chambers are actually lifts. And Brother Sully suggests that they are lifts to get people from the first floor. There will be second and third stories of that outer courtyard. So those little chambers, and these are the doors I was mentioning here. You see how they swing open? That's a floor plan where the door swings open on both sides. It'd be two sets of doors, as we mentioned. And I forget the size of them. I'm forgetting certain measurements here, obviously. But we'll run across that in a moment. So in chapter 40 and verse 30, these little chambers of the gate eastward will actually lift. And the beauty of that design is that you're not waiting in a foyer with people trying to go through or past if they don't want to go up to the second floor. In other words, what has to happen? The person has to walk in. They don't stop in front of an elevator. That's blocked off. And this is a base for the tower or for the pedestals. So the person has to keep walking, go through the doors, past the processing, if you're on the north gate, of the flaying tables, and then around and back down through here to catch one of these lifts. Perfect design. Really amazing design. And it happens the same way over here. People have to go on this side of these little chambers that are lifted. And it talks, Scripture says, three on this side and three on that side. So every little chamber was one reed broad. How long was a reed? How many feet? 12. Good. 12 feet. So you got a 12-foot elevator. Pretty good size elevator, isn't it? Yeah, have you ever been in one like that in an office building anywhere? 12 feet? The length of that, the height of this from platform to ceiling. Big elevator, dealing with a lot of people. You know, you get on an elevator and it gets real crowded and you think, oh boy, this doesn't feel safe. Why don't you get off? No, never mind. I'll get off. But in the kingdom, in the temple, this is going to be such precision stonework. I mean, you can see some of the ancient stonework that has been done. And I'm not sure we'll cover one of the slides, but I believe it's in the city of Chorazin, the one that Jesus condemned and said if works had been done in Tyre and Sidon. Chorazin, they have found that massive ruins of that massive city, and some of the stonework is absolutely amazing. You can't, in some stonework in ancient times, you cannot find the seam between giant stones that have been cut and pushed together. You can't find the seam. You'll be counting the stones and you'll miss a seam because it's so razor sharp. And so that kind of stonework is going to be developed and done, and the skills that will be manifested in this temple will just be beyond the comprehension of most people. They'll come to that temple and they'll look at it and they'll say, how did you do this? This is amazing. They will just be overwhelmed by the accuracy and the detail of that glorious temple in that day. So these little chambers are brought out in 1 Kings 14:27, just for those of you who are taking note, when King Rehoboam made in their stead brazen shields and committed them into the hands of the chief of the guard, which kept the door of the king's house. And it was so when the king went into the house of Yahweh that the guard bare them and brought them back into the guard chamber. And that word is in the Hebrew is ta. And so Brother Sully suggests that those same little chambers that were designed into the original Temple of Solomon are going to actually reappear in the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy. So we've noticed the access to those little chambers, to the Ta, going back to within the porch. You remember this account in the New Testament. So we're sort of drawing a hyperlink to the New Testament here. And it says in Matthew 26:69, now Peter sat without in the palace, and a damsel came unto him, saying, you were with Jesus of Galilee, weren't you? And he said, oh, no. But he denied before them all, saying, I don't know what thou sayest. I don't know what you're saying. And when he was gone out into the porch, another maid saw him and said unto them that were there, this fellow was also with Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he denied with an oath. I don't know the man. And we know the story and the account very well. The amazing thing is, when you go over there to Israel, and you can go down into the palace of the high priest and walk down the stairs underneath the ground level of Jerusalem, and you walk down in there and you can see, suddenly the guide tells you, you know, this is actually where Jesus was tried by the high priest. This is his palace where they brought Jesus, and they stood him right there in front of Caiaphas, the high priest, who was interrogating Jesus, and Peter was right outside here. And they show you, they walk you over here and say he was right here. Peter was right outside warming his hands, and when he walked over and Peter looked in through to see if he could see Jesus, he could see right through one room where this door entered into that room, and then it opened into an area where Jesus had his back, and Peter would have been able to see the high priest and the guards around him, and he could see Jesus' back. And then when the cock crew, Jesus turned around and saw him. Saw Peter. And Peter was kind of trying to keep himself concealed and inconspicuous and look in and see Jesus and see what was going on. And then Jesus squarely hits him in the eyes. And he just crumples. And he goes out. And he backs away and he weeps. Sick. Sick. And I'm not going to show you that slide tonight. Everybody in the room on that tour just loses it and just goes into this. You mean Peter was standing here and Jesus was standing there? Really? Yeah, really. Right there. And it just absolutely, in the porch, Peter goes out. When he was gone out, into the porch. Hurt. Hurt of others is what we have to avoid. Hurt of others. But healing others. And young people, we are the most susceptible to an uncaring attitude. Young people, I'm talking to you. We are the most susceptible to insensitivity to others because we tend to think about old number one first. It's all about me, myself, and I, isn't it? And not others. Others is too big a crowd. Those three are easy to fit up in here in my mind. Me, myself, and I. We're comfortable with them, aren't we? But boy, when it comes to going through the transition and the trial to get us from flesh to spirit, we better get this principle in our mind, the sacrifice of Christ for others first over ourselves. What happens on the porch? Let's go out on the front porch. Sit down in our easy chair and kick back. The porch is significant. And as we grow in our spiritual development and understanding, we'll go to Peter one day in the kingdom and say, Peter, let's talk about the porch. No, I don't think so. Not me. Y'all go talk to Peter about the porch, if you like. So, the columns, we've seen that the glorious architecture that separates these little these chambers from the posts. And we are only skimming the surface of the spiritual significance of this building because I really believe as we get into this framework, it begins the foundation, it forms the foundation of what the tabernacle in the wilderness pointed forward to. What did the tabernacle in the wilderness point forward to? Somebody tell me. It was a symbol, it was an education, it was a university of what? You're right. The ecclesia in the wilderness. We're wandering today. You and I, today, right now, we're wandering place to place, right? World, city to city. Like the tabernacle in the wilderness. You break it apart, you tear it apart, pack it up, load it up on the shoulders in the wagon of the Levites, and carry it to the next spot where God says to go. So we are a mobile sojourners, strangers, pilgrims in the wilderness, are we not? The tabernacle teaches the principle of our lives today. Quite mobile. We all even have our little mobile devices. So that means that the Temple of Solomon, when it was constructed with the help of Hiram, king of Tyre, with these beautiful cut stones and marble that Hiram and the Gentiles pointed forward to, that temple was more permanent, foundation, built, dug down, built up, columns, a structure that pointed to, beyond the ecclesial age, to the kingdom of which we're talking about today. So Solomon's temple was an object lesson of the kingdom age, a much more stable, crystallized ice age, right? So that means that the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy must do the same sort of thing. It's got to point forward to something like the tabernacle pointed forward to the ecclesia age. The Temple of Solomon pointed forward to the kingdom age, and the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy points forward to what? That's a hard one. But you know it has to. It's got to point forward. And you know it does. Revelation 21 describes the beauty of those men and women who are going to be constructed, who are being fabricated now with their vision on the beyond the kingdom age. Because the kingdom, as we mentioned earlier, is just a transition period. So the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, why is it important to study the temple of Ezekiel's prophecy? Because it's going to form a framework for us to flesh out. We're going to flesh it out. These are just the bones. This is just the skeleton of the spirit multitudinous Christ body in full, in toto, beyond the second great white throne judgment. Does that make sense? It does to me. Of course, I'm crazy as a loon. But I really think we don't think that far ahead. We think about just getting in the kingdom. If I can just get past the judgment, I know I'll be on my face, but if I could just get past the judgment and into the kingdom, whew, that's all I'm worried about. But really, we got to peg our mind on the glory of God covering the face of the earth. And when that happens, that will be the fulfillment of the type of Ezekiel's temple in the future, beyond the great white throne judgment, beyond all flesh and blood, beyond all carnal thinking, beyond sin and death, enemies which have been destroyed, and we will be in the glory of God's presence, everybody, God, all and in all. And I think that's what Ezekiel's temple is trying to tell us. And it's too hard, Brother Stan. It's too many measurements. It's just too many, too much. It's not. It really isn't. It's really an exciting study. It really is. Anyway, let's move on. Verse 14, under the post of the one of the court is a multitudinous one. It strikingly illustrates also that remarkable feature in the specification which helps so largely to the understanding of the vision, namely the use of a noun of singular number in a collective or plural sense, like the multitudinous Christ in Daniel's vision of chapter 10. His voice was as the multitude of waters. And that's how you know it was a multitude. In the latter part of the verse, we have the word post, so used. Unto the post of the court. Cannot have reference to one post only. There are many posts in the court, supposing they are all alike. Then post, a singular noun of number, is just as expressive of the fact as our use of the word man when we mean a number of men. Only we require to understand this use of the word in order to see the meaning of the specification. Sort of like when you talk about the race of man. Well, you know perfectly good and well that the race of man is not talking about one guy running a 100-yard dash. It's talking about mankind. That's a singular noun, man, used in a plural sense. And brother, in Ezekiel, the Spirit of God uses it all the time throughout the work of this vision. So that's what we're seeing as far as post. Okay? Same thing. Arches, similar thing. So 60 cubits, actually, at the end of verse 10, are for pairs of posts on either side of the gate. Each pair are linked by the arches. This view of 60 feet or 30 cubits for each great pillar, upon a surbase of 10 feet by 12 feet by 26 feet high, provides a better proportion for the height of the building with its galleries overhead. Up in this area, as you can see, these lifts that you have to go around through and come back on the other side will take you up to other floors of the temple. So, the spiritual lesson of the 60 cubit pillars that we read in Ezekiel 40 and verse 14, if you notice, it's talking about, and he made also post of 70 cubits, even unto the post of the court round about the gate. 60 of these. 60 cubits. There is special significance in the palm pillars, in that the man made the pillars. So these pillars, these posts that he's calling palm pillars, are a key feature in the physical temple. They are everywhere. The saints are described as pillars in Revelation 3 and 12. They are a key feature in the spiritual temple, as we mentioned earlier. And pillars stand for the righteous men and women supporters of the ecclesia. Tamar, which is a palm, is an upright palm tree, stands for the righteousness and uprightness of an individual. So Ezekiel 40 and 14, as we just read. Now, in Revelation 3 and 12, him that overcometh, will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem. New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. So it's really helping to clarify what's literal in Ezekiel, the temple, that will be a framework and center in order to bring the massive multitude that will be... You know, during the kingdom age, brothers and sisters, if you've never thought about this, death will be so unusual, as we know that a person 100 years old will be considered, if he dies, to have been cursed, because people will not hear about death. It'll be like, oh, did you hear somebody died? No. Yeah, really? Where? About 500 miles north in a town called Adam. Really? Somebody died? Yeah. And what did they do with him? Well, they had what's called a funeral. A funeral. Yeah, they had a funeral. A funeral? I've never heard of that. Yeah, a funeral. That man died. Oh, you're kidding. Can you grasp that attitude of the multitude that doesn't know sickness because the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations? They don't know death. They're not familiar with that curse because it's been moved away from the consciousness of the people. And you wonder, why are there going to be sacrifices in the kingdom of God? Well, there won't be sacrifices in the kingdom. Why would there need to be sacrifices? Because death is disappearing. Today, death, lucrative business. We're going to charge you for this coffin. It's a nice one. It's got shiny rails. Looks like walnut. We're going to have a wonderful funeral. It's going to cost only about a third as much as your wedding. Fall into that hole, young people. Yeah. This is going to be the first day of the rest of our lives. Let's go out and blow $25,000. Well, that's a good idea. Duh. Sorry about that. That's a pet peeve. The spiritual lesson of the 60 cubit pillars. The number 60 is significant. You know this already. I'm not telling you anything new. In the Song of Solomon, in chapter 3, verse 6, the marriage procession of Christ and his bride from Sinai to Jerusalem is described. You ever seen that? Let's go look at it. Song of Solomon 3, verse 6. The progress from Sinai to Jerusalem, Song of Solomon chapter 3 and verse 6. What in the world are you talking about, Brother Stan? And chapter 3 and verse 6, he says, who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, which we've been talking about, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold, his bed, which is Solomon's, 60 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it of purple, the midst thereof being paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold the King Solomon with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals and the day of the gladness of his heart. So we can see that the description, pillars of smoke, the Hebrew timaroth describes pillars like palm trees. And this is a manifestation, what we've just read, of Yahweh's power and his glory. In verse 7, it's linked with 60 valiant men, and the whole vision seems to be based upon David's bodyguard, composed of two groups of 30 valiant men each, found in 1 Chronicles 11 and 12, giving a total of 60. So the number 60 stands for supporters of the tabernacle of David. And as we said, considering the 60 pillars of the tabernacle, when you do a study of the tabernacle, and you notice that linen fence all the way around that separates, it's a standard of righteousness first and doctrine, that's what it stands for. First, you've got to have a separation and one gate facing the east through which an individual comes with proper understanding of the first principles in our day. So by describing the pillars of Ezekiel's temple in this way, attention is focused upon the number 60, directing the Bible student to find the answer in the lessons of the tabernacle and the beautiful Song of Solomon. Brother Stan Snow, I used to always look forward. Nostalgia breaks into your mind and you think about the 60s when I used to live in the music of the 60s. Always enjoyed that until I got up one morning and I was in my 60s. Didn't like that anymore. Ezekiel 40:16, we've seen that, we've gone through that. These are applied to little chambers, their posts, the arches. In verse 16, these narrow windows, we might spend a little bit of time on them. Margin gives 1 Kings 6 and 4, the words are rendered windows of fixed lattice work. Justinius states that these windows closed with bars are lattice. And Brother Sully suggests that these may be arabesque architecture, fretted tracery, a beautiful design of perforated work. And arabesques, is, if I'm pronouncing that properly, it may not be, but it's like stone lattice work that's been cut, perforated, designed stone lattice work through which the breezes will flow through and they will be intertwined with the most wonderful smelling flowers and flora that you can imagine, and this will connect these posts, these pillars, from top to bottom, and the arches, and Brother Sully has left them off of his architectural renderings, just so we can get a clear picture of the stone columns and things, but these narrow windows indicate some sort of an open screen work, about a cubit thick. Now that's pretty good size on each side of the gate building in front of or before the top, probably 6 cubits high. And he describes that in verses 12 and 16 that I'll let you look at on your own, the arches and palm trees. And Craig, I'm sorry, I have to keep asking you what my time is. Just, you don't have to run.
You have at
4:40. Yep. Okay. Very good. That I saved up earlier. The arches and palm trees mentioned in verse 16, verse 20, 22, verse 26, 31, 34, 36, these arches, this word arches is from the word ul and il, the root not used as a verb, but of wide extent in its derivatives. The primary notion is to roll. Whence ale, and the word el for God is from this root word. By ale, like means a ram from its twisted and curled horns. You take a paper towel, and if you just kind of grab the paper towel and pull it, you can pull it apart, can't you? But if you take that same paper towel and you twist it real good, it's harder to pull apart because that twisting of that fiber creates a strength. And so what we're seeing here as far as these arches, this ul, it's called also the belly or abdomen, as it says here, up here. Young's literal retains arches, and so does the RV. So the arch is in the shape of a rib, a rainbow, a horn, like a ram's horn. thus forming a curved line with great spiritual lessons behind them. The palm trees are upon the post, and these are really artificial. They're not real palm trees. They're stone. They're cut with stone and designed. And in architecture, a palm-like pilaster, these in turn demand great arches to span across the top, curved for great strength rather than a flat 50-foot stone lintel, which if you had the post and then you took this stone lintel and put it on top of them, it'd be a 50-foot span. But as we mentioned, over a period of time, it wouldn't have the same strength of an arch. We have a brother back in our meeting who is doing some landscaping in his backyard, and he's been building arches, a couple of pillars and a couple of arches out of stonework and cinder block brick. Sounds like a back-breaking project to me, but from the sound of things, it's going to be a really beautiful one when it's done. But in the kingdom age, during the temple, these palm trees are going to hold these arches, and that arch reminds us of the rainbow of which God gave to Noah as a token of his glory and of his purpose to cover the earth with his glory and to never again destroy it. So the strength of the arches is also seen in Roman architecture, such as the aqueducts that carried water from place to place. The arches, again, have been seen throughout history, used. Elam, this word Elama, probably from Strong's 352, a pillar space or colonnade, that is a pale or portico. And if you follow this word, notice that it goes, this Elam, it goes from that word which is in the Strong's 361, and from 352, and it goes, and now 352 is in the blue box, and that's El, from the same as 103. Properly strength. Hence anything strong, specifically a chief, political, like a ruler. Also a ram from his strength, like a pilaster is a strong support, an oak tree or other strong tree. It's translated mighty, lintel, oak, post, ram, tree. The same word, now the same word, it comes from ul, from an unused root meaning to twist, as we mentioned, by implication to be strong, such as the body is being rolled together and the muscles of the human body are rolled in such a way that it creates greater strength when pressure is exerted on it. So here you see an idea of that, of the way this tree is growing and is twisting. It would be much harder to cut that tree down than one that didn't have those twisting features of it. So ultimately, we can see that Elohim, coming from 430 in the Strong's, is the plural of 433 gods in the ordinary sense, but specifically used in the plural, thus especially with the article of the supreme God, the Elohim. So you can see an etymological relation between the wording of the arches and Elohim, because it comes from the same word. And you'll notice 433. So where does Elohim come from? Same place that Elam, arches, comes from, at 433 Eloah, and ultimately El, the shortened portion of that same word. Strength, an adjective of mighty. So these arches and the Elohim are the mighty ones, which really are the saints in those days. That's what they represent. So there's a tie-in, a beautiful tie-in, through just the following of the exegesis of that particular word. Palms, trees upon the post. Palm trees upon the post is an expression alike convenient and graphic for describing a series of slender ornamental columns standing upon pedestals and surbases than which a more fitting figure could scarcely be selected. So a post, ail, the word we just looked at earlier, would in modern technical language be called a pedestal or sub-base, and upon it another post could be placed, such as the ail, called in modern technical language a column or the pillar. So in chapter 40 and verse 7, when Ezekiel is told that then brought he me into the outward court, and lo, there were chambers and a pavement made for the court round about, 30 chambers were upon the pavement. and the pavement by the side of the gates over against the length of the gates was the lower pavement. Then he measured the breadth from the forefront of the lower gate unto the forefront of the inner court without 100 cubits eastward and westward. So this outer court, as we finally have gotten to, the outer court is the area of ground between the two rows of buildings that make up the square section of the temple. So it's that large outer court. And the inner court is beyond, towards the inner circle. And there will be 30 cella, because Ezekiel has only traversed three sides of the outer court. So those 30 cella is what he's in reference to on three sides of the temple where Ezekiel has gone. In 1 Timothy 3:15, we read a spiritual lesson regarding the post, the ground, the pillars. If I tarry long, Paul says to Timothy, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the ecclesia of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. So we see a hyperlink of ideas into our life in the ecclesial life. An ecclesial life, we are really making up the temple, aren't we, of the living God. And a temple in which God dwells only if we have the Word of God in our hearts and minds. Here's the outer court that we were referring to, and he's been describing these rows and rows and rows of pillars upon bases, these columns. This is 200 feet across, or 100 cubits. And the eighth step, just briefly, I won't go into reading all of that, but that eighth step is actually from going outside of the, if you walk through here, say that were the outside, you walk through and go across the court, through this gate and into the open area of the place left, and that would be just before you could see the outer, the inside circular row of buildings, the circular buildings, but you couldn't go in there unless it was for judgment, and we'll look at that in another class. But chapters 44 through 49, chapter 41, and chapter 42 through 14. Ezekiel is moved from considering the outer court ranges, and now he's caused to examine the central range, or the temple, the circular building. So it seems like he stands on the central mountain, looks first to the north, then to the south, and if the prospect, the panim, the face, is toward the south, then the building must be north of the point where Ezekiel is. He is told that these north quarters are for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the house, and the south quarters are for the priest, the keepers of the charge of the altar, terms which are defined in detail later on. And Brother Sully will go into those details. But the porch, getting back to those, are porches of the temple differ much from those of the outer court, but in one particular they're alike. In other words, there's two openings or gates in each porch. Thus we read, omitting the interpolated words, he brought me, this is verse 48, he brought me to the porch of the house. Ezekiel descends from the altar, enters the inner porch of the circular temple, and then the porch, as you can see, this is what that inner circular porch looks like. But he descends, this would be the curvature of this round circular building, the altar would be this direction. And Ezekiel is brought down and he is brought into that inner porch. So the inner porch, as it says, has two gates, ingoing and outgoing. He also measured the breadth of the gate, or the gap between the posts, on the inside and again on the outside of the circle. So he goes into a series of measurements of that inner gate. And it's similar to the ones on the outside, but this is now on the inside circular range of buildings, as we have shown you. So the porches of the inner circular temple are being described in chapter 40 and verse 48 and through 41 through 3, just for reference. And as he said, he also measured the breadth of the gate. And these are 3 cubits or 6 feet wide. You'll notice five cubits or 10 feet bases, 6 cubits, and these would be where Brother Sully suggests that the inner circular behind these massive statues with the face of a man, a face of a lion, back behind, when you go up these steps, right back behind these monumental statues are thrones, or where the thrones of the saints, the thrones of the disciples will be for judgment, as we will go like a priesthood in a rotating pattern. So the priest would actually, the king priest, when we would judge, for instance, if we bring up 10 cities of people as one of our particular our charges of 10 cities, we take individuals up, and they, if they appeal a case, and they can appeal a case, like to the Supreme Court, I would parallel this to the Supreme Court. Whereas if they are not satisfied with a judgment, they might have an appeal. And I believe Christ will, according to the Scriptures, allow that to happen in a process that will exalt God's Word in a public view, the way that Jesus was lifted up. If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto myself. And Jesus was crucified, according to the plan of God, in the public eye on a major feast day of the Passover, when all the Jews were there, and they were looking at the banner, the ensign lifted up. So if an individual says, I'm justified in my action, I believe they will be given an opportunity to go up to a very serious court in front of an immortal, in front of a series of immortals, but primarily one that will judge their case in the final end of things, and that's as high as you can go. You can't go any higher as far as appealing. So it's just a suggestion. I'm not saying that's the way it will happen. But if the thrones of judgment are where Brother Sully suggests, and it's a reasonable suggestion to me, that we can see that this is going to form a place. This is looking down as a bird's eye view. Where you see the lions in the earlier slide are actually located right here in this area. So these are the pillars right here, the bases. You can see the circles and the lattice work. These are where the lion would be facing this direction. And back here, before these doors, will be the thrones of judgment where immortals will sit. And not only will individuals who want to appeal a case have to pass through here, go up and pass or stand before in judgment before an immortal, but the Levite mortal priest, of which we'll talk about tomorrow, Lord willing, when they carry a portion from the outer range of the square building, when they carry a portion of the individual sacrifice, they bring it into this area of the circular building and through these doors. And they will have to pass one of the immortal judges who will be sitting in judgment. So, I think we've just almost... Can I go another 2 or 3 minutes, Craig? Okay, thank you. The area separating the outer square, just for your reference, this area, from the central, is called the separate place of the inner court. And this is this area, and this is the circular building. People will be allowed out in this area, in this area between the square and the circle, but not within the inner court, not within the inner circular range. So Ezekiel, as the frame of a city, the outer ranges are visible to Ezekiel at his first impression in chapter 40 when we first started this morning. And we see that the temple, the central range of the building, is the circular building surrounding the Most Holy. And the Most Holy is actually that area inside the temple containing the mountain on the top of which is the altar. And the separate place, as we said earlier, is that area of ground between it. The sanctuary is the translation of two Hebrew words, Kodesh and Mikdash, and the term most holy, which is found in the AV 7 times between chapters 40 and 48, also comes from the word Kodesh. So the word porch, understood in its plural sense, specifying a continuous series of porches in juxtaposition and surrounding the house on every side, on both sides of the temple, all around the circle. Now, I know that looks like a bunch of lines and, oh, what is that? But it's really just a design or a diagram to show you, interestingly enough, in the verses in chapter 41:1, he brought me to the temple, Haikel, translated temple, 68 times. He measured the posts, or the width of the posts, 6 cubits. And that's where you see here, he measured these posts 6 cubits, drawing this line, and the breadth of the tabernacle, in Hebrews, ohel, to be clear, to shine, glitter, to give light, to be round, ring-shaped, a tent of nomads, so to speak, always extension of tent, the round roof. But he brought me to the temple. So this is identifying the temple area. So the breadth of the tabernacle, Brother Sully points out that these particular posts all the way around the circle form a boundary for the most holy and for the cloud, which at times covers the temple, forming a tent over the temple. And what's interesting is that here's a cross-section. You can look at it from the towers. A person would enter in. They wouldn't go into the tower, but they'd go into the buildings that line up with this section of the tower. They would cross in. They would cross through that gate building, cross over the 200-foot courtyard, and then cross over the inner building, a gate building, and then into that separate place where fellowship would continue in that open garden area. There would be a garden landscaped area. But here's where he's talking about the Shekinah glory coming down over the most holy in that mountainous area, including the altar. So the direct glory of the immortalized saints would not penetrate that cloud until such a time as that cloud was raised and the sacrifices up on the altar would be offered and the individuals accepted by that fire. And Christ would officiate finally after the sacrifices have been conveyed. And they will be conveyed by a table called the table of the Lord that actually circulates, and that would be this blue area. If you see this, it's sort of dim, but that the circle or the table of the Lord would actually circulate all the way around the temple. And Brother Sully suggests that that table, amazingly enough, is only given two dimensions. You're not given, like in most of these measurements, you're not given three dimensions. You're only given two. And that's like height and width. But there's no length. And so he suggests that there will be a channel cut all the way around the temple, the circular temple. And that table will follow a channel of water, and it will be made of wood. And the table of the Lord will circulate, conveying from one point, any point in the, especially from the north where the sacrifices come in, those sacrifices portions will be set upon that table by an immortal, because the exchange was made when the mortal Levite priest walks in from the outside carrying that sacrifice. He enters in past that immortal on the throne here, enters in through the doors, and meets an immortal priest at this point, somewhere in here, takes the sacrifice, hands it to the immortal takes it from him, and turns and walks to the table of the Lord, and places it upon this circulating table that will revolve around the entire circular range of buildings. And as that circulates to the eastern point, the farthest eastern point of that circle will be the ascending ramp, in which we don't have a slide of yet, but that ascending ramp will be where the immortals take it up into the altar and place it there for the ceremony that will then follow and bring glory to God. And if it's accepted, then everybody's relieved. If it's not accepted, then there's a problem. And the individual will have to then face a certain judgment if his sacrifice is unacceptable. So there can be some very dramatic times during that process. But the altar will represent the ultimate God and sacrificial manifestation that everybody will see at a certain point when the Shekinah glory is lifted above the altar. But otherwise, it's believed it will veil and conceal the divine glory. We're going to stop there, and I'm going to turn it back over to Brother Craig. And thank you so much, brothers and sisters. I know it's been tedious. I know it's been technical. But there's a reason for these measurements, and thinking hard on them and trying to, and I encourage you to get into the book, the study itself, identify these things in your margin so that you can really get a dimension and see yourself in that temple. Thank you, Craig.